in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia especially, is a republic. In Qatar, we need a republic. There is no time, there is no space for an absolute monarchy, especially a monarchy that is corrupt, that is bringing terrorism to the world and against its people, obviously. But so really, it is for the benefit, the economic, political, stability, security benefit of the world and the American people to bring an end to these monarchies, not by war, but by sustained political pressure. There are a lot of people in my country who dream of the day that they can run for office as the president of the Arabian Peninsula instead of living in an absolute monarchy. The American government reaction has not been supporting this goal of building a republic based on the rule of the people, of the people, by the people, for the people. I hope the American people will fill in the void that to support our goal for a political system that is open, that is free, that gives the individual their freedom and liberty and their right to live free of any religious or ideological restraints.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I've been speaking with Ali Al-Ahmed. He's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs in Washington, D.C. And in his statement today, Ali says the solution for this tragedy is not to go around shutting down mosques in France. It is to end the support and weapons the Saudi regime has gotten from the U.S., France, and other countries. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The time is 6 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 Community Radio. Coming up next is Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline, and Hard Knock Radio at 7, so stay tuned.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hey, hey, how's it going? It's November 16th, 2015. Thank you for joining us, Labor Radio. We hope you're doing well, either getting off your shift, about to start work, or relaxing at home. We're glad you could join us. My name is Stephanie Patricio. I'll be your host today and every other month. For Labor Radio Hour. Today, we're going to jump right in. We're going to be talking with Toya Lewis, who is an organizer in Louisiana, New Orleans specifically. Toya Lewis is the founding member of Black Youth Project in New Orleans and an organizer for Stand With Dignity, also in New Orleans at the Worker Center for Racial Justice. So we're going to dive right in with Toya, learn about the work that she's doing and why it matters. Toya, do we have you on the line?
Yes, you do.
Hey, Toya, how's it going?
I'm good. Pretty good.
Right on. Cool. I heard that you're in the Bay Area. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm in the Bay Area.
What are you doing in the Bay Area? How's it going down there?
Well, just chilling, escaping New Orleans for a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'll be back to work soon.
Right on. That's good. We all got to take some R&R.
But also, I gotta also say, Thursday through Saturday, I was at a Black Worker Center conference where Black labor organizers from across the country gathered together to talk about either building Black Worker Center or pushing the narrative for Black labor organizing.
That's great. That sounds like amazing work. I want to make sure that we talk about as much of the work that you're doing as possible. So if it's cool with you, let's touch on that. But first, can you give us some background? Who's Toya Lewis? What do you do? Where are you from? What motivates you to do this work that you're doing right now?
Oh, cool. Okay. So once again, I'm Toya from New Orleans. I was born and raised in the Calio Project, the public housing resident in New Orleans. So I grew up in public housing. I grew up, my parents were low-wage workers.
What did they do?
My mother was a nursery teacher, and my father works at a hotel, but he worked at, like, three different restaurants in the French Quarter when I was growing up. He finally landed this job in the French Quarter, and he finally landed this hotel job. Hmm. And probably like 2000, the year 2000, okay. And he's been there ever since. Yeah, he finally finds something to lock himself in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, growing up, I didn't think I was poor. We felt rich, even mm-hmm. though I grew up in the projects and we grew up on food stamps. Mm-hmm. Felt like I had enough.
Yeah, that's...
But I'm sorry?
Oh, I feel like I hear that from a lot of... folks that just, you know, later realize that they grew up in poverty. It's like you don't grow up feeling like you're poor.
Exactly. Not until you start watching TV and see how much people really have in this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I really saw myself in really deep into the work. When my public housing resident, the Calio Project, was being torn down and rebuilt, and I saw folks organizing in my community to get work on the site, which is something that they were promised when developers came down and
why
talked about rebuilding.
Why were they tearing that project down?
A lot of reasons. One of the excuses was that Hurricane Katrina damaged them. But we're finding out now that it was plans that was in the works for many, many years, but Hurricane Katrina actually gave them the ammunition that they needed to do a full tear down of public housing residents. Mm.
And do you believe that this was all premeditated to get rid of low-wage black folks that were living in the projects, and that Hurricane Katrina just exacerbated that or made that easier for the government or other folks to be able to do that?
I would say it wasn't the folks that they were trying to get rid of. I think they were trying to get the land, right? So that the part of the city I grew up in is accessible to downtown, accessible to the French Quarter. Mm. It's a good place to live, and as well as many other public housing residents in New Orleans. I think part of it was not to get rid of the folks, because the folks are still needed, because the low-wage work that happened in the French Quarters, where people, you know, where the city makes billions and millions of dollars, mm-hmm. They still need those low-wage workers mm-hmm. there. But those low-wage workers was pushed out into the suburbs of New Orleans to live on Section 8.
Mm. Okay.
So as a result, a lot of people got lost, stuck in Texas and other states across the United States. Mm. But a lot of people just can't, you know, like myself, just can't stay away from New Orleans because it's home.
Yeah.
We still, you know, we came back, and a lot of the people that came back are the low-wage workers who service hotels and restaurants and whatnot, and still making the wages that they made before Hurricane Katrina, while the cost of living has risen, major. It has risen a whole lot since then.
Mm-hmm. And I know that that's... talking offline and like just hearing about some of the work that you're doing, the impact that Hurricane Katrina has had on the organizing down there. Can you speak a little bit on that?
So it's been a strong rush of grassroots organization, nonprofit organizations. While we've always had our mom and pops who were pushed to make sure that the community had what it needed without 501c3s, all the funding from Ford and Kellogg. This is new form of organizations coming down. I say a good thing about it is there's some organizations that's organizing from a grassroots level,
mm-hmm.
which has actually opened the door for me to do some organizing work myself. You know, it's organizations that see the potential in community members actually leading the fight.
That's right.
That's got me doing the work right now.
Yeah. What was an organization that you felt like really brought that out in you or saw that in you? Because I think that's important to talk about, right? I think marginalized folks often get put into these nonprofits and aren't seen, right? For the things that we bring to the table and the experiences that we have. So, just in calling that out, what was an organization that you felt really pushed you to that?
So Stand With Dignity, the organization that I still currently work for,
yeah,
was the organization. Like, I started with Stand With Dignity in 2011.
Okay.
As a member, and we were pushing, we were pushing this policy called Section 3, which is a policy that was won during the Civil Rights Movement in 1968.
Okay.
And it stated that, every time a contractor gets funding from HUD to do a contract, 30% of the new hires should come from the community. Mm. So we was pushing for that contract to actually be enforced, and we also ended up pushing to revise the local policy. We not only got it enforced and won 50 jobs, but we actually added training clauses, because a lot of people was locked out of work, like myself, because we didn't have experience. Contractors would say we didn't have enough experience, which is funny. Which is funny because a lot of people was locked out, had been doing construction work forever, but just didn't have the credentials to prove to the contractors. We got a training clause that stated for every $100,000 a contractor received, they should train one person in a certified apprenticeship program.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And we also wrote in a community workforce agreement statement policy. And what that means is that community start thinking about contracts with apprenticeship, people who run apprenticeships, and contractor and the developer before the project gets started, but we never was able to enforce the community workforce agreement policy portion of the Section 3 policy because we live in a right-to-work state down in Louisiana, and contractors were threatening to sue Housing Authority in New Orleans if we had pushed hard enough for that policy to actually happen.
Wow. I have a couple of...
It was through that push that one of the organizers of Stand With Dignity saw how involved I was in the type of work that I was doing, and decided to bring me on as an organizer with the organization. I had already been, deeply rooted and deeply involved as a member, but it was through all that work that they wanted me to come on as an organizer and not just be a member of the organization, but actually do the work.
Right. I'm wondering what was happening in 2011 to have this.
Stephanie?
Hello. Hey, hello. Sounds like we're having.
Sorry.
Hello.
Yeah, you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you. You there?
Okay.
You good?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, cool. I'm wondering what was happening in New Orleans in 2011 for all of this organizing to start happening. Can you talk a little bit about that, or what was really pushing the community to push this policy, the Section 3 policy that had been in place since 1968, you had said?
Yeah, since 1968. In 2011, four major public housing residents was under construction. Mm-hmm. And still, in 2011, we found that 52% of Black men in New Orleans were unemployed as well.
Wow.
So Stand With Dignity and a bunch of other organizations started to push to make sure that people from New Orleans was able to get some of the construction work.
Right.
Not only were we pushing for Black, well, Stand specifically, not only were we pushing for Black workers to get work on the construction site, we was actually kind of expelling the myth that the Latino workers were taking all the jobs,
mm-hmm.
and also there's this organization called the Congress of Day Laborers.
Okay.
We're working, they work with us and we Stand With Dignity. We did store circles and whatnot to expel a myth that all Black people were lazy, right? So we were building Black and brown unity all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
As we were trying to get Black workers work and trying to... in the exploitation of brown workers, we was making sure that we wasn't looking at each other as enemies. We recognized that we both had a similar enemy who would rather us be enemies than see them as a real enemy.
Yeah, and I, as you're talking, I'm wondering how important it is to do that work, but also, why does it matter that black and brown people are unified.
Yes, yes.
Because it matters, right? Like, that totally matters. Like, for the organizing, we know that at the end of the day, the bosses will always try and divide working people, right? From your point of view, like, why does it matter that the Latino and the black workers were not were unified in this? Like, why does that matter?
Well, so I can go way back.
Yeah,
it's always good to understand that that this country, the United States, actually thrives off of free and really, really cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the immigrant community, today is a community that the capitalism loves to exploit. Once upon a time, it was easier to exploit black workers.
Mm.
Once upon a time, we was more than just cheap labor. We were free labor.
Mm-hmm.
We was actually kidnapped and brought to this country to mm-hmm. be free labor. And it's because of the exploitation that both black and brown people have received in the labor force that we got to be unified. And it's the power that that so many of us have. Like, it's more of us than any amount of money that big corporate America could put together. Like, and if we unified and understand
mm-hmm.
that true enemy and understand the forces that we can use against these enemies, then we can win. That unity actually helps us win. And also, you know, once again, going back to just understanding that all they want to do is exploit us,
mm-hmm.
right? And that we must work together to end that exploitation.
That's right. Why don't we talk about Stand With Dignity? And if you don't mind, I'm going to read a little description off of the website. Just to contextualize and give folks some idea of what it is that STAND does. So STAND With Dignity, to define, create, and speak for ourselves. STAND is a grassroots organization of low-income residents and workers in New Orleans. As survivors, we believe unity and self-determination are our most viable solutions. Now more than ever, when city, state, and federal government have turned their backs, we believe grassroots leaders must come together to take collective action to change our condition. We seek to transform all systems of exploitation and racism through organizing the power of the working poor. To this end, we pledge to ensure the rights of workers and residents to return and recover. So let's talk about STAND. You said that, you know, they're an organization that you felt that had really seen you. What work have you done since 2011 when you were working on the Section 3 policy? And what does STAND do?
Okay. So I talked about in that Section 3 policy how we tried to win the community workforce agreement, which would have actually gave community power to actually put things in place before the contract before the contract mm-hmm. was signed, sealed, and ready to go in place. So just in 2000, in the summer of 2014, we went to the aviation board because the New Orleans International Airport was getting ready to do a $500 million contract. So there was these two big conglomerate contractors who were bidding for this contract process.
Mm-hmm.
And before we can let the aviation board pick a contractor, we stepped in to do our research, understand who the contractors were, and also make sure, you know, step in to make sure that we can make sure that the aviation board knew our demand as community. So we went to the aviation board to let them know that they should slow down, be careful not to pick any racist contractors, because
mm-hmm.
you got a lot of those in New Orleans.
We wanted
to make sure that we had a voice, and access to work. We wanted to make sure that we had safe working conditions, that contractors were going to pay workers a living wage, which we were asking for 15, which is a national acts for a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to make sure that there were training opportunities. With so much of our tax dollars being spent on this project, we really need to make sure that there's opportunities for people. And the last but not least, we wanted to make sure that there was a process for transparency and compliance, so that when contractors wasn't meeting the community needs, we had a space to speak on it, to talk about it and actually resolve it. So we presented these things we wanted at the Aviation Board and actually slowed down the process to the point where we was actually able to create a parallel bidding process to the process that the Aviation Board had in place. The Aviation Board had a request for proposals. Mm-hmm, that they put out, and we put out our own community request for proposals, where we asked for the four or five things that I just mentioned, and we even asked the two contractors to submit their bids to us as well. Even though they didn't submit their bids, one contractor actually submitted a letter, and it was like, we understand what you're asking for, just wait and see at the Aviation Board here, and we may just have something you want. And other contractors just completely ignored us. But I think it was a day after the contractors submitted their bids to the Aviation Board, we sent in, it was like a legal term, a request for information.
A FOIA? A request for information, what you were saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Aviation Board actually released the contractors' bids to us. So we were able to oversee their bids, even though they didn't give them to us. The Aviation Board did. We oversaw their bids and found that both contractors were shady. We actually had to pick the lesser two evils. The lesser of the two evils we found, when it came the day for the Aviation Board to have their hearing on picking a contractor, the lesser of the two evils actually put forth $2 million towards workforce development.
Wow.
Mostly because we stayed on them to let them know that that's something that the community needed. And they ended up putting that $2 million in place, and the city got control over that $2 million and created the Network for Economic Opportunity. Right now, Stand With Dignity sit as outreach partners in that network. And it has a lot of work. We still have a lot of work to do, but creating that presence was really really great and really powerful and uplifting for our members.
That sounds amazing. That sounds like, as you're touching base or as you're touching on the points, it does not seem like easy work at all to be doing. It seems like extensive work and institutional work, like making sure that you're able to hold the contractors accountable to the impact that they will have in the community. I wanted to take another step back and really quickly, because we're actually running out of some time here, but talk about the work that you that you do as a Black youth. As a founding member of the Black Youth Project, are you there, Toya?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Thank you for breaking up.
Uh-oh. Can you hear me now? Toya Lewis is a founding member of the Black Youth Project. For many of you that do not know, Black Youth Project has been involved in many of the fights for $15 an hour for fast food workers, for young Black workers. And so in this moment, I'm really taking the time to be able to speak to that work and why it matters, right? Toya, just shout out if you're there or if you want to interrupt. But in this moment, right, specifically as Black communities are stepping up and saying that they believe in dignity for their communities, specifically why that work matters, right? Just today, I think a lot of folks of color have voiced that, we get told day in and day out that white folks don't see color, that white folks don't see why it matters that people of color are organizing, and really bringing to that point, like, actually it does, right? So when we talk about organizing specifically around our identities, as people of color, as women of color, as queer folks. We do so because we believe that ultimately these are the fights that are going to ensure that we're not only treated with dignity as people, but as workers too, right? Because each of us has to put food on the table for our families. And the way that we do that is through sharp analysis of what's going on, right? We know that there are millions of workers in this country, but our struggles are not all the same, right? The struggles of white workers, if we look at the wage gap in general, white women are compensated at a much higher rate than our Black women, than our Latina women. And so how do we get to the root of that if we're fighting specifically in this moment, specifically for Black communities, for folks to be able to live their life and just be able to walk down the street safely? What does it look like to take on that struggle within the labor movement? And why does that matter, right? I think specifically as... you know, Toya was saying about their work, what does it mean to have Black leaders or Black folks in leadership at this critical moment in time when folks are rising up and there is a real vibrancy or a real tenacity that folks are having in their struggle to simply live better lives or to simply live. So Toya, are you back on the line?
Yeah, I'm back.
Great. I think folks are tired of hearing from me. I want to hear from you about your work as a founding member of the Black Youth Project. You know, I've been hearing in the news a lot of the work that YBP does, and the mutual friend that we have in common, Key, was telling me that you are a founding member of YBP. Can you talk on that?
Yeah. So we got started back in October 2014, we had our first action November 30th, 2014, right after hearing, the same week after hearing the verdict not to indict the officer who killed Mike Brown. Hmm. And we've been pushing and having actions. One of our big pushes have been around the racist monuments in the city of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And we actually got Mayor Mitch Landrieu to agree to taking down four of them. Three of them that connects to the Confederacy, mm-hmm. and one of them connects to the Crescent City White League. It's a monument that's in honor of white supremacy winning the war against Reconstruction, which happened right after Emancipation Proclamation, mm-hmm. when President Abraham Lincoln, enacted Reconstruction for Black people to be able to get back, mm-hmm. not get back, to get us to actually get into society as mm-hmm. regular citizens. But there was a war in New Orleans and in many other southern states. There was race wars to actually dismiss Reconstruction. And that monument is in place because Reconstruction was dismissed. And a lot of black people, white police were killed in the midst of that. So those four monuments, the Mammoth Landrieu is asking to be taken down, which is a longer process than we want to see, and it's way less monuments and street names than we want to be taken down. We recognize that racist monument is psychological terrorism. Mm-hmm. And we know that we will never live in a world where we're as Jewish people to live on Hitler Street, go to Nazi schools, but we have to go to Robert Lee Elementary School and walk down Robert Lee Street, knowing that Robert Lee fought to keep black people enslaved. So that's been one of our biggest push for BYP 100. We actually been joining the fight for 15. Both BYP 100 and Stand with Dignity joined the fight for 15 actions locally.
We're running out of time, Toya, but I have just one last question. You know, I think especially here in Portland, as an organizer of color myself, as an Indigenous person, I feel like we get a lot of blowback from from folks, from white folks saying, why does it matter that you're organizing around your identities? That's not the way that we organize around labor. So the question that I have for you is, why does it matter that Black folks are organizing now, and how does that solve the issues of poverty? How does that drive towards economic justice? Like, why organize? Why organize the work that you do, or why do the work that you do, and how does that ultimately win Black communities economic justice?
So unions have been in place since 1830, right? And mm-hmm. and from 1860 to 1861, unions was trying to figure out how to get more jobs, because the labor force was saturated. The labor force was saturated by slaves, by those of us who were, my ancestors who were enslaved, and they needed to desaturate the labor force, which actually ended up creating a civil war, right? Mm-hmm. So they needed Black people, even though we were working for free. They needed us to be out of the way so that they could have work, right?
Mm.
And so many events happened after the Civil War to now. But we live in a time now where it's still a push for middle-class workers, white workers, to have work. I told you I was at the conference in Oakland.
That's right.
The Black Workers Center convening in Oakland. And I talked to young Black organizers from the South, the Midwest, the West, and the East, and even in the East, where they have a whole lot of labor unions, that's what you call it, where labor unions prevail.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the term.
They're historically, they're more rooted, or they're more prevalent.
Yeah, like